Hi, everyone. This is Coach Fav speaking today on behalf of Casinos USA Podcast. And welcome to our 72nd podcast, Lock It Down or Give It Back. And we're coming to you today from beautiful Western Pennsylvania with this fall weather upon us. Leaves are changing. What a glorious spot on the face of the earth, Western PA. And we're joined today in our studio by a small digital group. Welcome back, friends and neighbors. And let's have a little bugle charge and start our show. Well, podcast number 72 is titled Lock It Down or Give It Back. Lock It Down or Give It Back. And frankly, that's a major issue for anyone who gambles in a casino. And whatever the game is or the slot machine is, the question is the same. When do you lock up a win and call it quits? Because the longer you play, the likelier it is you're going to give it back. You know, I think about an analogy like this. You know, how is gambling like a pizza oven? Well, when that pizza's in the oven, at a certain point, it's perfect. And if you keep it in the oven, it will suddenly burn and it will be destroyed. Oh my goodness. The gambler's lament. I should have quit when I was ahead. Sometimes you have to just sense when it's time to pull that pizza out of the oven. How else can you say it? And we all make this mistake. We just think that our luck, you know, going against the odds, of course, because everything in a casino has a house edge. Well, we think it's just going to keep going on. Like, you know, we're Miss Lucky or Mr. Lucky, but suddenly it changes and we just can't get it back again. So how do we deal with this question? When is it time to lock it down or give it back? Well, just a couple of days ago, I was taking our dog, Oliver, on his twice-a-day walk, and I ran into a neighbor. You know, Oliver, I call him a palm chow because he's part Pomeranian and part Chihuahua. And the Pomeranian part, he's a cutie for sure, and he loves people. He has people skills. You may have heard a couple of the podcasts about his people skills. But the Chihuahua part, when he looks in the mirror, he doesn't see a little dog. He sees a grizzly bear. He wants to fight every bigger dog there is. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, he likes our neighbor. We were standing and talking with our neighbor. And I said, hey, how's the Rivers treating you? That's a local casino for us in downtown Pittsburgh. And my neighbor is a big slots player. And he said, hey, well, I was just there a few days ago, Sunday, I think he said, and he was playing a dragon machine. You know, one with those dragon heads that come floating by. It's kind of a cool visual effect. And he said on the first crank, he won 35 free games. And he just sat back and watched. And slowly but surely, over the 35 free games, he came up with $375. And I said, wow, congrats. I said, I got to tell Jenny that she loves to hear about slot machine wins. I said, so you came home with a couple hundred dollars. He said, no. And I was afraid of what was coming, and I was right. He said, no, I came home with $65 because I didn't stop. I gave it back. And hence, I said, we better talk about this on the podcast. When do you lock it up, and when do you give it back? And I know exactly what happens sometimes. You win early. You know, you go to the casino for a few hours for some recreation, you know, with your significant other or with a group of friends or even by yourself. And, you know, nothing wrong with winning. But when you win early, it's even harder to stop because you've just been there 20 minutes or so. What do you do? What do you do? That's the first thing I think we should address.
You are one pathetic loser.
Well, I don't want to be a pathetic loser. And I think that's where it starts. Like, just remind yourself how you're going to feel if you give this $300, $400, $500, whatever it is, back, right? You're going to think, like, what the hell's wrong with me? And so people, I think they create their own little ways to deal with this issue of locking it down and not giving it back. And with slot machines, I know a lot of people cash out. You know, they'll cash out. Say my neighbor cashes out, but that $375, and he puts that slip in his wallet, okay? And then he sticks in $10 or $15 or $20, you know? And he's saying, that's it. You know, we could talk about leaving the machine, or you're thinking, oh, it's too hot. So you want to put in another $20 of, you know, cash. And remember, you have that bankroll $375 on that voucher in your wallet. Some people like to change games, you know? If they won big on a slot machine, go try a table game and play kind of softly, you know, with low limits. Those are things you could do. If you're a drinker, some people like to just fool around with a few hands of video poker and go very slowly, you know, at the bar in the casino. Usually they have video poker machines there. But if you continue, it's very likely that that $375 will just go down and go down and go down. Now, it's also likely that you'll win, but remember, the odds of it going down are much higher than you continuing to win. You know, I know you can quit too early. I know you can leave a craps table too early. I know you can leave a poker game too early. But it's how often do you do these things? I mean, if you're a regular at the casino, you know what happens most of the time when you don't quit when you're ahead. You have that gambler's lament. I should have quit when I was ahead. It's a sad thing. That's important. For me personally in craps, if I secure a big win and I don't want to leave the table, then I'll just go to placing numbers at a very low rates. You know, say I'm at a $10 table and say suddenly I have some good fortune with hard numbers, or there's a short run on numbers, making points, and I'm on the pass line doing what I do. And all of a sudden I got $600, and I think, well, I got another half hour here before I do anything else. So, you know what? I'm just going to get down and place the six and the eight at minimum levels here. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm still going to be very guarded, you know, because if I start to lose money that way, I just have to walk away. I'm not giving back $600. No, I'm not giving it back. I'm not saying I always felt this way. But because I go to casinos so often, I know what happens if you don't lock it up. And good fortune can suddenly become just ordinary fortune, or even worse, bad fortune. And how about sports betting? Oh my goodness, Casinos USA, first 2 weeks of the season, man, we were rocking. And then we ran into a Saturday, the third week, with a lot of upsets, and a lot of people that expected the teams that we picked to win, as we did, were disappointed. You know, it just happens. Things change. But I'm going to tell you this. Every time I get to $100 in profits at the end of a betting sequence, you know, after the end of a Saturday, the end of a Sunday, I'm going to take it out. You know, I can do that in the app. I just have them transfer it to my checking account, or ask them to send me a check, you know, and that's something the Rivers will do. We play betrivers.com, which is legal for anyone who resides in Pennsylvania to do. So you need to think of strategies, like what can you do to lock it up? The good old days of Las Vegas, I heard this story, and hey, I think we have a lot of credibility. You know, we have a daughter who lives in Henderson, and you've heard Jill Nicole on the show before, and she calls in sometimes and lets us know what's going on in Vegas. But now we have a grandson, one of Jill's children, who is a dealer at the Strat. You know, so we have a young blackjack dealer in the family. And, of course, because we have family in Las Vegas, we're there very often. We'll be leaving for Las Vegas October 1st. We'll be there 4 days and nights, and then on October 5th, that's a Saturday morning, we'll be flying to Reno to visit one of Jill's children also, who's a freshman at the University of Nevada, Reno. So we'll be spending 4 days in the row. It's three casinos that are connected, not too far from the UNR campus. We'll be there. So now we think we have a lot of credibility, but I heard stories of people who have won in Baccarat particularly, or blackjack, $40,000-$50,000. And the advice they get is, get the hell out of Las Vegas. Take the next flight out if you can't quit gambling, you know? Now, these stories come from the time when there was just Las Vegas was the only place you could gamble, or maybe Atlantic City, you know, if it wasn't that long ago. But it's the truth. And you and I, it's a little different because we can gamble, you know, in 41 states now. So you would have to be stronger in your decision. I'm not going to fly out of Pittsburgh. I'm not going to fly out of Vegas if I'm winning, but I'm going to stop being foolish and risking a lot of money. That's what it comes down to. So if you want to enjoy gambling without going berserk and becoming, you know, one of those persons that has strong self-loathing because you just lost after you had won so much, then make sure for you, you have some strategy, some win limit where, you know, I've won this much. Okay, I might play 150 of it or even 200 of it, but I'm going home with this much no matter what. I'm done. Okay? And that's all about discipline, self-discipline. And truthfully, you know, if you're a grown-up and if you're listening to this gambling podcast, I hope you are, then you really know that the only kind of discipline for adults is called self-discipline. You just have to have the willpower to say, I'm done gambling for today. Please take this seriously and embrace the concept, all right? And that concept would be lock it down before you give it all back. One more time with me, friends. I'm going to lock it down before I give it all back. Okay, short break, and we're coming to chapter two. Hang on. Well, I hope you think you're pretty good at what you do. And I'm not talking about recreational gambling here. I'm talking about what you do to earn a living, you know, a job. I hope you think you're pretty good at it, you know. I hope you enjoy what you do. And when you think like that, I know there's these professional scouts that scout high school talents. And many of them have camps, you know, that parents send their high school students to, soccer camps, basketball camps, 7-on-7 football camps, kicking camps, all right? Well, I want to know something, all right? There must be a number of people who work in this arena of trying to evaluate high school talent and then getting information to colleges, you know, and getting so good at getting young people scholarships that the families in that particular area are willing to pay a lot of money to send their children to these camps. So if they're so good at it, how do they miss these players that walk on that didn't get any scholarship from any university or college? And yet they walk on, okay? And they're unbelievably talented. Oh, I want to talk about two people today. How can this happen? How can people miss these people? There's a football player at the University of Notre Dame. Notre Dame's a top 10 team. I don't think they're in the top 4 or 5, but you know, they're a really good team. And they have a player named Fink. His name is Chris Fink. And he's a fifth-year senior. He's, you know, that means he's in graduate school. It's only his fourth year of eligibility, but he's been elected captain of the Notre Dame football team. Well, when he arrived at Notre Dame, he walked on. They gave him permission to walk on. Nobody else wanted to give him a scholarship, and neither did Notre Dame. And now he's captain, and he's a game breaker. Oh, I just saw him the other day run 50-some yards on a shovel pass. What are we going to do? I got a better one than that. How can you become a walk-on? You don't get a scholarship. You end up being close to being a superstar and team captain. Okay? How does that happen? Who missed this kid? Well, of course, Notre Dame has since given him a scholarship. But the question is, who missed this kid when he was in high school? How could you miss someone that talented? There's even a better example. at the University of Nevada, Reno. When do you hear this story?
Ah, you're going to speak up.
Okay, I'm going to speak up. So the University of Nevada, Reno, they're playing in the Mountain West. In the first game of the season, they hook up with a Big Ten team, and the team is Purdue University. And Purdue last year, if you remember, they smacked Ohio State. So they go to Reno for their opener thinking, hey, this is an easy one, right? They're 24-point favorites. Well, the game goes back and forth, and a lot of good things happen. And with 2 seconds left to go, all right, the University of Nevada has the football. And to win the game, the score is tied. They would have to kick a 56-yard field goal. 56-yard field goal. You know, three-quarters of the NFL kickers can't kick a 56-yard field goal. Well, the scholarship kicker, for whatever reason, wasn't doing so well. And the coach named a walk-on named Brandon Talbot, who had never kicked. He's just out of high school. He never kicked in a game before in college, all right? He goes out, lines up, and he kicks one 56 yards to beat Purdue. Okay? Now, all these kicking camps in California, that's where he's from, a California high school, nobody offers him a scholarship. People have seen him kick. Well, this last weekend, the third week, he kicks 4 field goals, which lifts Nevada to a 19-13 win over Weber State. Now, I want to ask you, now they put him on scholarship, but that's not the point. Brandon Telton, T-A-L-T-O-N, high school senior, right? Who missed this kid? A 56-yarder with no experience and then kicking 4 in one game? Oh, UNR is lucky to find this kid and let him walk on. And then only after he proved himself did he get a scholarship. But my point is, you think you're good at what you do? Some people aren't as good as they think they are. They just make too many mistakes. They overlook too many things. And if you're a sports bettor, those are two great stories. The UNR walk-on place kicker and a Notre Dame captain who walked on because nobody else would give him a scholarship in Division I. Oh, my God. So that's how it works. And I have to say, I do think I'm pretty good at what I've done. And I really worked hard at being good at what I did. And I feel the same way about this podcast. You know, I put a lot of time into talking to people. And again, having a grandson and as a dealer in Las Vegas is a big help. But also talking to dealers around the country because we travel so much, visit casinos. We're not perfect. I'm not saying that. But we think we can offer you an entertaining podcast with a lot of great information. And that's going to lead me into our most popular segment. It's called 3-2-1 Craps. 3-2-1 Craps is a strategy that we use for low rollers from the pass line, which we are sometimes. Sometimes we play as low rollers from the pass line. And Jeremy Ellerick, who is the producer and narrator of Color Up YouTube videos, He has a number of them, and he's very good at producing them and narrating them. Asked if he could use our 3-2-1 strategy, and he did. And even though it hasn't been a year yet, it has had over 120,000 views. So we're going to go to our crap segment that we call 3-2-1, and we're going to give you our best advice. Sincerely, if there's one thing you can do in craps, I don't care what strategy you're using. I don't care if you play from the dome pass. I don't care if you place numbers. I don't care if you make prop bets. If there's one thing you can do, I'm going to give you the best advice. This is what you can do to make you a better craps player and to make you more successful. So we'll be right back with our 3-2-1 craps segment for craps people and people who are learning about craps. Give it a listen. Short break, and we're coming right back.
3-2-1
So let's talk about something that maybe many of you thought about before, and that is when you consider the thousands and thousands and thousands of crap games going on in the country, what is the average length of a roll? You know, someone goes to the table, plays, and then suddenly the dice belongs to her or him, and it's their turn to roll. So if you're going by averages with thousands and thousands and thousands of bits of information, how long would one expect to roll? And the first mistake you might make is when you consider these, that person might throw a 7 on the come out, then she might throw another 7, then she might even throw a craps number. So maybe before she establishes a point, she might throw 2 7s and a craps number, 3 rolls. So you always remember that generally people have a very good chance of throwing more than 1 7 on it, you know, and then starting a new game. But still, it's all part of their first time they touch the dice. And when you consider all that, all the possibilities, the number that the mathematicians agree on is 8. That's the average roll. And you're probably thinking, oh, my goodness, I wish I'd have been at that table, because most of the time it was 2 rolls or 1 roll and people were 7ing out, you know, 7 out. Hey, real quick, when you're shooting the dice, you can crap out, you know, by throwing a 2, 3, 12 and lose money on the pass line. But once the point is established, don't say crap out, because once the point is established, rolling craps numbers won't hurt you. You have to 7 out. You have to throw a 7. That's just a little thing that irritates me. Okay, well, back to the point. So what you need to understand to be more successful financially as a craps player, and if you're a pass line player or a place better, is that the average number of rolls, even counting those 7s and craps numbers that someone might throw, is 8. So the longer you stay with money on the table, the more dangerous it is that you'll lose that money. So let's just say what this may happen to you. Let's say you are playing conservatively and you have $5 on the pass line, and the number that's becomes established as a 9. So you put $10 behind the pass line, you have $15. All right. And then to make it a little more possible for you to win some money, you also place the 6 and 8 for $6 each. All right, so you have $15 and $12 together. Now you have $27 at risk. And on the 4th roll, somebody throws a 6, so you win $7. Okay, and they throw 5, 6th time, the 7th time, the 8th time, and you stay on there because you've only hit $7. And the next roll, the 9th roll, they 7 out. So you had $27 at risk. Well, they hit your place number one time. You lost $20. And this happens again and again and again. So how long do you stay in the game with place bets before you take them down? Well, let's go back to the scenario one more time. Okay, so remember the established point is 9, and you place the 6 and 8. Okay, well, someone does throw a 6 on the 4th roll, you get $7. And then someone throws a 6 again on the next roll. Now you have won $14. Okay, now on the 6th roll, they throw a 10. And then on the 7th roll, they throw an 8. So now you have $21. So you say, think of these terms now because it's easy to remember it this way. If I go off now, I will have secured $21 and I only have $15 at risk. I have $5 on the pass line and $10 in odds behind it. So I'm going to go off. I just tell the dealer, take me off on my place bets. And she puts a button saying off. Now your pass line bet is still alive. And you're risking now $15, 5 on a pass line and 10 behind it. So you can't lose. The other decision you can make is, well,
I can pick up my odds bet. Never forget that. And just play the pass line. I can't pick up the pass line bet. I'm committed with that. I'm not allowed. It's a contract bet, it's called. You can't pick it up. So that's the point. If you decide not to do this, think about playing it this way. If you decide that every time I go to a craps table, I'm going to make a pass line bet, put odds behind it, and I'm going to place numbers. Let's do this. Let's put $100 in every number. All right? $100 on the 4, the 5, the 6, the 8, the 9, the 10. We're not going to play the pass line or the dome pass. We have $600 at risk. Okay? And we're just going to let the shooter roll numbers and we're going to get rich. How many times do you think people make money that way? Yeah, well, they might pick up a 4. They might pick up a 5. They might pick up an 8. And they're making more than $100 each time, right? Because they all pay different odds. But when they lose 600 smackers. So they have to get at least 6 hits to make any money, right? Or 5 hits. It's real close. If they were rolling 4s and 10s, it'd be real close. But still, nonetheless, when you get popped, I remember the game at Rocky Gap Casino, and my dealer friends from the Meadows came down. Meadows is a casino a little bit south of the Pittsburgh airport, and I go there often, not as often as the Rivers downtown, but I go there often. And so, you know, they came down to see me because I had said I was going to be at Rocky Gap, and we were playing craps together. And, you know, sometimes dealers play the worst way. I'm sorry if that's offensive, but you just wonder. And they weren't putting $100 in every number. They were putting $60 in every number. So
360 at risk. That's a big, big risk.
And a young lady was shooting the dice, and she was rolling numbers. I mean, 12, 14 numbers she rolled, and they were making money. No question about it. But the next several shooters sevened out, sometimes on the first roll after they come out, sometimes on the second or third roll. And before too long, our dealer friends were in deficit. So you probably wouldn't do that. You probably wouldn't put $100 or $60 on every number, would you? No, because you think it's too dangerous. But in essence, you do the same thing when you refuse to go off on numbers. You know, it's not a big deal. And so I suggest that you consider it. I think it's the number one thing you can do, you know, outside of strategies to play. I think it's the number one thing you can do. When you're facing a cold table, take a couple hits and go off. And you know what? If you win the table, you can't lose. That's when you've won more money on your place bets than your pass line and odds bet behind it. That's what we call owning the table here in the Pittsburgh area. So it's up to you. If the table's hot, yeah, you stay on. But if the table's just cool or cold, one hit, two hits, three hits, that's your decision. But go off before you lose everything that's out there. All right? I hope that makes sense. And we're going to come back with our final segment, Chapter 4 today. And Janie and I are going to discuss something that we've been discussing for a couple years. But it's big news, Chicago Tribune. The millennial makeover of Las Vegas. It's here, and it's getting faster. The millennial makeover of Las Vegas. Hey, we'll be right back after a short break, and we're bringing Janie back with us. There was a story written in the Chicago Tribune, and it was picked up by newspapers throughout the country, so your local newspaper may have it too. The title that we have, there was a picture of a Las Vegas sign, and it says, "See ya, Celine, hello, Gaga," and the story, it's kind of a catchy headline, but the story's more, it's deeper than just about Celine and Lady Gaga. It's about the millennial makeover of Las Vegas. And that's something that Jane's been talking about is probably more than I have. So I'm going to let her open on this. So what's your reaction to reading about the millennial makeover?
I have to say, I'm not surprised. You and I have talked about it numerous times that the millennials do not want the amount of gaming or gambling. They want gaming, but not necessarily gambling. In Las Vegas, they like to go to Las Vegas. Who doesn't? I mean, for activity, for food, for fun. It's just a destination to go to.
Well, 3.6 million people visited the Strip or Fremont Street last month. So how many of those were millennials?
Probably a little over 1.5 million. So everything has to change, or a lot of things have to change to the way the millennials like it. And I did mention gaming versus gambling. So increasingly, I think Las Vegas is embracing other forms of gaming, including the video variety. The Luxor, for example, and we've been there, we've seen it, added the HyperX Esports Arena. It's a 30,000-square-foot high-tech video gaming stadium with tiers of player stations. So you can play regular games in there. They also have tournaments, and it's just an amazing facility. And it's very popular with young people and with their parents, too. And at the MGM Grand Hotel, there's a 12,000-square-foot level up, and that offers classic pool, foosball, ping pong, as well as an arm wrestling table and a giant Pac-Man. But its next-gen pool is a 2,000-square-foot black box room that serves as a setting for virtual reality powered by zero latency. Players will wear VR goggles and backpacks and roam untethered through video worlds that range from armed zombie hunts to wayfinding in the tropical paradise. Now, this is about $50 a person. And also at the MGM, fans of the Hunger Games series can enter the cinematic version of this, including a credible iteration of the tribute train and nearly 30 original costumes through the Hunger Games, the exhibition. The show culminates in archery training with resistance commanders and a time test of your accuracy in hitting video targets on a 60-foot screen. Now, I have been quoting and reading this from the article from the Chicago Tribune. So it just goes to show you that gaming is still very popular, and millennials like gaming. They're competitive, but it's not necessarily the slot machine, table game type.
Well, for years you've been talking about this, and we've had some of our listeners actually comment on it. They thought it'd be very helpful that you've said, you know, you enjoy gambling, but you're not going to sit and gamble all day or sit and gamble all night. You're interested in other kinds of experiences you can have, whether it's dining, whether it's entertainment. But I want to talk about that headline for a second. You know, there's a new group of entertainers taking over, you know, the T-Mobile Arena area and other venues in Las Vegas. And, you know, it's not Elvis impersonators anymore. And let's face it, the groups from the 60s, they're still out there in the casino circuit, but they're in their 70s.
Well, let me give you an example of someone who's getting $60 million and isn't in the 70s is the DJ Marshmello. He just landed a job at the renovated Palms. He's going to be in charge of Chaos, the DJ at Chaos with a K, which is a 73,000-square-foot day club and a 29,000-square-foot nightclub. So, and he has all the, you know, newer performers with the Cardi B's, Alicia Keys, G-Eazy.
Are they just paying him a few bucks for this?
Well, no. The headline says it's $60
million. $60 million?
Wow. Right. And this is the newly renovated Palms. The Palms is featuring the entertainment part of the package that the millennials like. I will say, though, that Aerosmith has a residency now at Park MGM. My daughter went to see them and said they were great. She thought Steven Tyler didn't seem to have aged. And Sting is coming soon. So there's still a lot of us out there. I will say, when you mentioned the groups of the 60s, that you and I are watching them because they're at all the little local casinos. They're at casinos in Michigan City, Indiana, and in Aurora, Indiana.
They're at many tribal casinos.
Right. So they're making the circuits there, and their concerts are sold out with baby boomers. So let's not make that less. It's just the fact that Las Vegas, to survive, as they always have done, keeps reinventing itself.
Well, I'm not going to pay to see Frankie Avalon, but I agree with you. I'll pay to see Dion DiMucci. Dion in the Belmonts, remember him? He's from our time. But let's face it, these millennials, it's going to be increasingly more their entertainers than our entertainers.
Which is okay, because I'll take my younger grandchildren to see them.
And the last big area of influence the millennials are having, and it's a big one, is dining in Las Vegas. And I guess there's no better example than what, Janie?
The Eataly, which is in Park MGM. My daughter went there already, too, and texted us pictures from there, and it looks amazing. And she said, the minute you walk in, the smell just about, you know, you're overcome with these beautiful smells and aromas. It's a 40,000 light flooded square foot facility, and they have stalls devoted to pizza, pasta, panini, and everything else. It's two stories, and it resembles an old world train station. And it's not the only culinary draw there. They have waiters in track suits and rolled up chinos delivering shareable plates of dumplings, kimchi, fried rice. They have the Best Friends restaurant, the first Nevada-based restaurant by L.A. chef Roy Choi, who gave the world the Korean short rib taco. Chicago's represented by the elegant but unstuffy Bavette Steakhouse and Bar. And the same can be said for Nomad Restaurant, a spinoff of the New York original in a two-story book-filled library where Chef Daniel Hum serves his signature foie gras stuffed roast chicken.
And finally, you know, the millennials have demanded a better way to check in, you know, the registration lines. And, hey, I'll be damned. I'm excited because we use this automated check-in.
Ourselves.
Yes. You want to explain how that
we
works?
We use this at Bally's ourselves, probably last year for the first time, and we're delighted with it. We didn't have to ask anybody for any help. We just went in, and we had all you know, had everything on. It was already online, but there was a kiosk right in front of the registration desk, and the registration line was long, so we said, hey, let's give it a try. So you put in your credit card, and it was all done automatically, and it shot out two room keys. I mean, it happened in a matter of...
Well, you need your confirmation number.
Right. You have to have some information. Anything you'd need for check-in, you need there. I'm just reminded of the 1 year that we were staying at Mandalay Bay, and I walked over to the registration desk. My husband had checked us in, so I didn't have to do that, but I was worried about the following day's checkout. So there were about 10 employees working computers there, checking people in and out. And I said to the one, I said, gee, is there any way I could check out early for tomorrow? And she said, oh, absolutely. She said, we'd love that because we're going to have several thousand people checking in and out, and especially checking out.
So, dear listeners, what it comes down to is that there's just been changes underway, and many of them are completed. You know, the Ling Promenade, the park outside of Park MGM on the way to T-Mobile. It's just a place that the millennials really, by their demands, have created. But we love it, too, and we're boomers.
Well, another great addition is the hockey team, the Golden Knights hockey team that's there, and the coming Raiders are going to be there. So, and the Aces, the women's basketball team. So Las Vegas has become quite a professional sports city where it wasn't allowed to have any for so many years.
So, you know, Janie's been right all along, and I'm sure there's many, many others out there that, you know, would love to go to Las Vegas, but they don't want to stay in a casino, you know, all day, and they don't want to stay at a casino all night. You know, they don't want to gamble, you know, 9-10 hours a day the way it once was in Las Vegas. And because the generation of the millennials are making demands, and 40% of the visitors to Las Vegas, be it the Strip or Fremont Street, are millennials, things are changing. And Janie and I are saying, for the better. They're changing for the better.
So that brings us to the end of the podcast.
The mission at Casinos USA is always life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Casinos USA is a special place where every day is Saturday. We're going to close today with a different theme from the 60s by The Who, talking about my generation. You'll hear from us next when we get back from Las Vegas around October 10th or 11th. So long.
Try to put us to down. Our generation, just because we get around.